KPBS On Demand is supported by the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego, presenting For Dear Life, Art, Medicine, and Disability, an exhibition exploring how illness and disability become catalysts in art. Learn more at mcasd.org.
Previously on Port of Entry.
Hello.
Bueno. Miguel Angel?
Sí.
Oye, Miguel, I just forgot to ask. How much did it cost to build the compounds in your house?
Oh, well, it's actually a lot cheaper than building with conventional materials.
We left our last episode learning about how to build with earth-friendly materials, but wanted to follow up with Miguel Angel Perez,
an expert in earth building in Baja,
about the costs of building this way.
Our producer Julio made it to Miguel Angel's homestead in Cuatro Milpas, a neighborhood on the outskirts of El Sausal, around 45 minutes from the border.
Miguel Angel's house sits at the back of a four-acre property, which is divided into three different parts. At the front, a school.
In the middle, a small horse stable and a corral. And all the way to the back, tucked between two hills, sits Miguel Angel's property.
On the way there, Julio was greeted by a couple of horses roaming on the property leading towards Miguel Angel's entrance.
There were two gates that separate the homestead from the road. A small pack of three dogs alerted of his arrival. The slight slope up to his property was littered with dried reed. On the left side, on the drive up the hill, a couple of reed structures stood tall.
Just beside his property, next to the horse corral, was the beginnings of a biopool, or an artificial water reservoir, that he is building with his neighbor, the owner of the horse stable and corral.
Okay.
Miguel Angel explained that they just had a construction workshop with reeds a few days earlier. He pointed towards the structures Julio had passed when he got there.
Walking up the stone-laid path, there were two structures, his main house and the bathhouse. Once there, Miguel Angel explained how his homestead operates entirely off the grid. There were no connections to sewage or the electrical grid.
Everything, including electricity, was fully self-sustained.
En la zona del Sausal, esta es la primera casa de Cobb. Pásale, pásale. Y pues tenemos como árboles, composta.
His wife Adriana, a trained architect, was there with Remus, a nephew that was visiting from Oregon.
¿Podemos pasar?
Sí.
Pásale, pásale.
Hola.
Hola, Adriana, ¿cómo estás?
Bien. ¿Tú?
Bien, bien.
Bienvenido.
Ok. Wow.
Ajá.
Nomás me toca verlas
en construcción, pero no terminadas.
No terminadas.
Alejo, ¿cómo estás?
It was her first time seeing a completed house built with earth materials.
The main house was constructed from cob. In case you didn't tune in last episode, it's an earth building technique consisting of a mix of clay, soil, sand, straw, and a binder. When fully dried, it forms into a hard and durable material comparable to concrete, but with superior insulating properties.
The house had a living or green roof. A bed of dry grass with different cacti sat on the top.
On the right side of the roof, next to the plants and facing the sun, were three solar panels connected to a charge controller that charged four golf cart batteries where Miguel Angel stored his electricity, and with an inverter, he distributed electricity to his house.
About 10 feet away from the main house was the bathhouse. It was built using a technique called wattle and daub, or as Miguel Angel calls it, bajarreque.
The bottom of the foundation had a French drain with a dry stack of rocks above it, where the rest of the structure rested.
So what it is are some kind of reeds, and then these reeds are covered in clay. So in this case, this is also a technique called yurt, you know, building a yurt.
Mm-hmm.
A yurt is a type of portable round tent traditionally used by nomadic cultures. It's constructed with a wooden frame and covered in felt or fabric. But in this instance, they were using natural local materials like reeds and clay to create a more durable structure.
So if you would have only the carrizo walls, it's pretty flimsy, or if you have cob that thin, or it's very, very flimsy as well. But by combining them, you have this beautiful structure.
Adriana designed it. I just was basically helped her execute it. She took the time to actually put all these bottles in place so that we can infill them with a clay mixture. And then what you see inside here, this is a lime plaster that's only a base. This is a base coat, because on top of this, what we would like to do is a burnished lime plaster called Tadlac, which is waterproof. And she also designed a reciprocal roof on the top.
The bathhouse was also built with repurposed materials, like glass bottles that served as building blocks and as tinted glass windows, which gave the inside of the bathhouse a beautiful, warm hue.
At night, when we leave the light on inside and you see outside, oh, this building looks amazing. Looks like a, I don't know, like some kind of living mushroom of sorts.
According to Miguel Angel, building this type of way is best suitable for rural areas, where you're not bound by city building codes and where building materials are more readily accessible and cheap.
Just a little side note about the cost. Here, I guess the only thing we had to buy was a copper pipe. I like the copper pipe and the wood. The wood was leftover wood from lumber yard, and that cost 500 pesos.
Just the wood.
Just the wood for the top. Probably the when it was 20 pesos to a dollar. Right now it's more like $17.50.
Wait, so about $100 for materials, Julio?
Yeah, definitely about $100. Yes, and they also used some repurposed debris, like wooden tiles or the wine bottles. That, of course, and some elbow grease.
Dude, that's stupid cheap. I wonder how much this would cost in the States.
A lot more for sure.
I'm pretty sure.
After the tour of the bathhouse, Julio and Miguel Angel continued the tour to the main house.
Right there. And this is your living room?
Living room slash kitchen.
This is like a study or a room?
That's actually a bedroom.
The inside of the house was about 500 square feet divided in three sections. The main entrance led into a combined kitchen and living room with two open rooms on each side. Pans and pots were hanging from the walls near the kitchen side of the house.
And you have bajareque, just walls that aren't, like, very private, but, you know, just separates the rooms. Okay. You have our earthen floor. Our kitchen is made of cob. So is our bench here made of cob.
There were no doors separating the rooms from the kitchen living room, although they were each divided by a wall that did not reach all the way to the roof.
Each wall had carved bookshelves, made out of the same material as the bathhouse, which held pictures and books about earth building and architecture.
It was cute and rustic, like one of those boutique Airbnbs that are never available to stay at.
Yeah, we just decided just to leave them like that for light. I don't think I'd ever build a house with the walls like that, but we were kind of thinking more of like, just to be private, but we wanted the airflow and the light.
To the left was the master bedroom, and to the right of the kitchen was a slightly smaller guest room. Both of the rooms were not that big, but could easily fit a queen-size bed and still have some leftover space. The ceiling was made out of wooden beams and stood 9 feet from the ground.
Julio and Miguel sat on the cob bench, and like last time, Miguel pulled out some homemade kombucha and shared how much his house cost to build.
But you know, this house costs $6,000 to make, because I'm only talking about materials invested. All the labor was all volunteered work, including myself.
Hold on, let's pause here. How much would it cost to build if you were to hire a building crew?
If we take Miguel Angel's cost as reference and take in Baja's labor costs, which is around $50 per worker per day.
For folks who don't know, the minimum wage in Baja is about $20 a day, but no one works for that little.
So with a small crew of 5 people, it would cost around $15,000 to build the same house in 2 to 3 months, or around $20,000 if you want to get fancy.
But hear this, according to Buildable, a local contracting company,
that same house or something with the same dimensions in San Diego, but built using conventional materials,
would cost between $200,000 and $250,000.
Labor costs can be at least the same amount as the materials, but probably more. Especially
double
here.
Double that.
Easily.
If you cut the last episode, we left off discussing the impact building with earth and clay has on the planet. Today, we explore the building costs of using natural materials, what it means for folks looking for a housing alternative, and why this hasn't taken hold in city settings.
Today, we're diving into the planetary scale, part two.
If this is your first time tuning into the season, we're showcasing stories of people with out-of-the-box approaches to common problems.
This season is all about visionaries and shapers of the borderlands.
From KPBS, this is Port of Entry,
where we tell cross-border stories that connect us.
I'm Alan Lilienthal.
And I'm Natalie Gonzalez.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
You're listening to Port of Entry.
So, if building with earth materials is cheaper, has anyone else taken advantage of this method? You would think people would be eager to adopt this alternative, right? Well, some people have.
We met with Rachel Formanek, a New Yorker who's made a remote hilltop in El Zarzal her new home.
Earlier this month, Julio and Alan visited her property, about an hour from the border and 10 minutes north of Ensenada.
Rachel, how's it going?
How are you, Rachel? Buenos días.
Buenos días.
¿Cómo estás? Abrazo. Hola, rápido. Muy bien. Your boys are here?
Yes.
Your puppies?
Tofu.
They met Rachel by the roadside.
Her explorer's hat kept her curly, dark blonde hair together and protected her face from getting more freckles.
She was waiting in her old white SUV for them to follow her, her two dogs eagerly poking their heads out to greet them. The way to her house was steep, rough terrain.
So cool. Do we follow you?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a climb, but you'll be fine.
Okay.
Rachel is part of Tekyo, the earth-building collective we featured in the last episode. Other members have been helping her build her dream home.
Once Julio, Alan, and Rachel arrived, she began sharing how her homestead will be shaped and what brought her there.
Okay, so I am building with Cobb. This space is going to be a kitchen slash consultation area. I practice Ayurvedic medicine. And so the idea is it'll be one open space type of building. Windows on that side, you know, to catch the mountain view.
Rachel is looking to become an Ayurvedic therapist, an alternative health practice originating in India. Rachel wants to make sure that the house she lives in, or in this case, where she'll work, is made of all natural materials and causes little to no harm to the planet.
All of the rocks I collected from here on the property to fill it, so that was a process, but it's one of my goals to use as many materials as I possibly can from this property or from, you know, the local area.
The structure resembles a baseball diamond, with the batter's plate facing the mountain view.
The dimensions were close to 500 square feet. So far, she's completed the foundation and about a foot and a half over the ground. Next to the compound is an Econoline van and a metal freight container that acts as her temporary living shelter.
Right now, I sleep in the camper van, and then I've got my kitchen and stuff in this shipping container. And the idea is that eventually I want to build the main living area on top of this shipping container.
We initially thought she was building her entire homestead out of clay, but the way she plans to integrate earth-building techniques with the existing material and structure she already has surprised us and downright impressed us.
You know, the big vision is that this space is a workshop inside this shipping container, and then above it will be the main living quarters. So very kind of tiny house size space, small kitchen to be able to use when you don't want to go down there.
When Rachel talks about her home-building plans, a spark of excitement brightens her hazel eyes. Her enthusiasm was infectious and definitely left us wanting to hear more about her vision.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, eventually. Like, when I build up there, what I want to do is this technique called light straw clay. So you frame it with wood, and then you put forms on either side of the 2x4s. And then you take this mix of straw with really, really watery clay, and you dress it almost like you're dressing a salad, just like a nice, like, coating, right, of this, like, liquidy clay. And then you put it down in the forms, and you tamp it down. And so you do that until it fills up the whole cavity, right, the whole, like, box that you've created from the 2x4s. And then that becomes your insulation and the structure of your wall together. So it's a really, really fast, economical way, and it's light enough that you can do it on a second story.
So her current setup will eventually lead to a much more complete homestead.
And then down here, this is going to be that kitchen slash consultation area. And then down below it, eventually a bio pool. And then the gardens will just spread out around from here. And so there will be garden beds over this way. I want to do as much permaculture as possible. Have herb gardens, vegetable gardens, that kind of stuff over here. And then a therapies room eventually over here. I'll use this space for now, but in this kind of space that looks over the mountains, there will be a therapies area.
That sounds very cool, but why is she here?
Whoa, slow your horses. I was just getting to that. Rachel, like many other Americans, chased her version of the American dream for a good decade in California, but that didn't quite work out.
I had a job doing accounting for a school district, and, you know, I wasn't able to make enough to live on. That wage, you know, wasn't enough to pay my rent and take care of what I needed. And after they took out my taxes and benefits, it worked out to maybe like $12 or $13 an hour, which, you know, you can make that in and out, right? Like there wasn't a lot of incentive.
Around 2010, the income she was making was not enough to meet the increasing living costs. So she looked for job alternatives and found one in Humboldt County. A very green alternative, right, Julio?
She joined the Green Getters.
The Humboldt Hookup.
The Emerald Ecstasy.
The Wondrous Weeders.
The Marijuana Machine.
Okay, we get it. She started picking pot. Can we move on with the story, please?
Yes, of course.
So I was in the cannabis industry in Northern California for about 8 years. And, you know, I did a little bit of it all. Like, I did some black market work. I did some legal market work. I worked in dispensaries. You know, I did some trimming. I did a lot of gardening. And that was what I really liked the most. You have this opportunity to make a lot of money, to work seasonally, to be outdoors, you know, to not have to necessarily pay rent if you don't want to, because you can be camping and living there.
Trimming weed paid very handsomely back in the early 2010s. According to Rachel, people in this industry made around $7,000 to $10,000 a month, depending on your per pound trimming yield. Some even racked up to $30,000 per season. That's just for a couple of months.
Cool, where do I sign up? For almost a decade, Rachel rode the Emerald Wave. She joined many seasonal workers from all parts of the world, the so-called trimmigrants, a play on the words of trim and immigrants. Get it?
These seasonal workers would spend harvest season working in the California weed fields and would head back home to enjoy the bounty of their harvest.
But California had other plans. On November 8, 2016, Californians voted to legalize recreational marijuana, making it a haven for cheap pot.
Hey, Adrian, cue the November 8th, 2016 archives.
At the stroke of midnight on New Year's, California will become the 8th state to legalize recreational marijuana.
Medical marijuana was already legal in California, but the passage of Proposition 64 means that the state is now poised to become the world's largest legal weed marketplace.
As dispensaries started rolling out and weed was more easily accessible to users, like with any other product, the more there is in the market, the cheaper it becomes.
As legalization happened, there was all of a sudden this kind of push and pull between the legal industry and then the black market industry. And the price has fluctuated a lot. I was going back and forth working seasonally up there which worked really well for a while. And then eventually the prices were just so low that I couldn't justify it in terms of the gas money to get there than I was making. And that was part of kind of what pushed me here. And
the honeypot from where she and many others were making a killing suddenly vanished.
But she still held to her dream of traveling the world and being a landowner. She just wasn't going to give up on her own American dream so easily.
So she shifted gears and started looking for ways to not lose all that hard-earned money to the ever-increasing living costs of California.
And so obviously in California, the thing that's the most expensive is rent. And so I had done a lot of that like overland kind of travel and thought, okay, well, I'll build out a van. But to build out the van, I was so lost. And so I signed up for some carpentry classes at College of the Redwoods up in Humboldt County in Northern California. I get to school, and one of the classes was building a house. And so we did everything from the foundation to framing the walls. We did the roofing, like everything. And that process really inspired me to think, okay, well, now I can build a van and I can build a house. Maybe I could build my own house.
Rachel sought ways to build her own living space.
Like retrofitting her own van into her own mobile living quarter.
But she couldn't rely on conventional materials.
Her dream of becoming a homeowner was a bit more complicated. She needed specific construction materials due to an ongoing health condition.
You know, it kind of all came together with my own health journey of having some autoimmune type symptoms around that time, where I noticed that they became a lot worse when I was working with the commercial construction materials. Like, I would notice my symptoms getting a lot worse when we worked with stuff like that. And so that kind of got me thinking, okay, like, I love this. I love building. I want to build my own house. There must be ways people are doing it that's more ecologically friendly, right? There must be ways they're doing it that are less toxic. And
her health condition, coupled with the high, borderline unaffordable cost of living in California, limited the options she had available.
She needed to use alternative construction materials to build her own house, but one big obstacle stood in her way.
The strict California building codes.
Well, and that is, like, if you're talking about, like, why not California? Because it's not really possible. I mean, I guess it, in theory you could do it if you had so much time and money and probably lawyers to help you get it through, right? But to me, that's not realistic. I don't have that budget, you know? And so, yeah, this in the United States would be very, very difficult to do.
Because of all the building codes.
Because of the building codes, because of the permitting, because of, yeah, just all of that. And even the materials, you know, and even stuff like collecting your own rainwater, you can't necessarily do that.
So Rachel, being a free-spirited traveler, stumbled upon the possibility of her present 10 years earlier.
I came here, I traveled through here maybe 10 years ago. I was doing a big overland drive through Central America with friends. And when we crossed from San Diego, this was the first place we came, was to like Tijuana and Ensenada. And we were supposed to stay for 3 days, and 3 weeks later, we were still in this region, you know, just fell in love with it. And so I really wanted to buy something and live here eventually someday. You know?
Fast forward 11 years to 2021, and 30 grand later, Rachel now owns 2.5 acres in El Sausal.
Surprise in Spanish. Did you say 30 grand?
30 grand.
Cool. 30 grand? I'm hoping to buy land
down
here, too.
Holy shit, that's so cheap.
Mm-hmm. But what about the construction materials? How much is she spending on the whole compound?
How much do you think I'm going to spend?
Yeah.
That is a great question. I've been doing it so just piece by piece as the money comes in, you know, so I haven't really looked at a whole budget. I'm very fortunate that the build itself so far, I think I've spent, so let me think, probably the bags. I did buy some of the bags from the bakery. So that would have been about 500 pesos. And I probably spent about another 500 pesos on the straw. And then the sand was the most expensive thing. I got a whole truck of sand, and that would have cost me like 200 something dollars. So really, I mean, on the materials for the build, what's happened so far, I've spent about like 300 bucks. The Yeah, like the doors that I bought over there, those were $600 after paying.
She wasn't sure exactly how much the total cost would be, but based on what she already spent, she'll need about 5 to 7 times that amount to finish the structure. That's just for essentials like more sand and basic materials. If she wants to add extras like decorative doors, wooden beams, or a nice roof, the estimate jumps to around $5,000 to $10,000 for materials alone. So, to be safe, a budget of $15,000 would give her some room for unexpected costs.
Okay, but what about labor?
Well, she also has that figured out.
Right? And that's a great thing about the TechU group. You know, one of the neighbors down the road fixed his part of the road, and I think he spent like 15,000 pesos doing it. Whereas I had the TechU people come up and we fixed part of my road. We did it in 4 hours with wheelbarrows, right? And I just made lunch. So it's just this, you know, if you have the time and the people, you can accomplish a lot.
For those who don't have the TechU labor hookups, if we had to guesstimate, how much would labor cost?
Like we mentioned earlier, it would cost around another 15 grand if you consider how much it costs to hire a group of 5-day laborers in Mexico, depending on how long it takes you.
So Rachel's home would be costing around $25,000 if you wanted to build quickly and fancy, plus the cost of her land plot, which would place her grand total at $55,000.
Imagine trying to do the same thing in the U.S.
That would be completely out of her reach.
Seems like she made the right move.
It was very good timing moving here, right? As everything in California was starting to kind of go out of control. But I felt like I was getting out at the right time. And definitely because now with the prices and the way things are, it would have been impossible to save up and make this transition. So,
back in 2021, Rachel unintentionally caught herself in the midst of a wave that has made her a part of a tsunami of California residents flocking south looking for affordable living conditions.
In Rachel's case, affordable and non-aggravating living conditions.
Port of Entry will be back after a short break.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kara Felt, Curator of Photography at the San Diego Museum of Art. We're pleased to welcome to San Diego Pre-Picte Human, the latest exhibition from the world's leading award for photography and sustainability. The Museum of Photographic Arts at the San Diego Museum of Art is the only U.S. venue on the international tour of Pre-Picte Human. See work by 12 shortlisted photographers, including the award-winner Indian photographer Gauri Gill, in the celebrated exhibition Exploring Human Experiences. Pre-Picte Human is on view now through December 15, 2024 at MOPA at SDMA in Balboa Park. Learn more at mopa.org.
You are listening to Port of Entry.
If building with earth materials is such a reliable and affordable way of building, why hasn't it been embraced in city settings?
To help us answer the question, we met with Alex Ruiz,
Tecate's Director of Urban Planning and Development.
Bueno.
¿Qué onda, Alex? ¿Cómo estás?
Hola, bien. Aquí ya, cenando. Bueno,
comiendo. Qué bueno. ¿En qué parte estás?
Alex is a researcher and professor at two of Tijuana's technical universities, Tecnológico de Tijuana and Universidad Iberoamericana.
He's also a colleague and good friend of Alex Santander, the architect that we featured in our last episode. Alex and Julio made their way to Casa de la Cultura, the cultural center in Playas de Tijuana, a beautiful hacienda and esplanade that exhibits classical beam and column architecture typical of colonial buildings.
When we asked him about the viability of using earth building in city settings, it became clear that the situation was more complex than it seemed.
The main difficulty is how you deal with all these legal institutions, all these superstructures that they aren't quite related to aspects of functionality or structure in the building process, but rather to protect the users. What we need is to create a legal framework for Adobe to be actually sustainable, not in the ecological type of conception of what sustainability is, but in the legal, institutional, economic, day-to-day practicality of it.
Right now, according to Alex, those who design the building codes are the very same industries that develop the materials used for construction, which then are handed to the city for them to implement and regulate.
For instance, in Baja California, there isn't yet a code for adobe. It doesn't mean that you can't work one, create one, and publish it. But I think there's still some resistance, not necessarily from the bureaucrats, not necessarily, but rather from the construction industries and all of the architects and builders and engineers that went to the school and learned only that type of substance. Concrete, steel, I would call the mainstream construction systems, that there is a clear framework to work with them.
Turns out the rollout of adobe in urban areas is less about the material itself and more about the institutional framework needed for society to rely on earth materials like adobe or cob, similar to how we use concrete or steel beams.
This raises the question, can we truly replace concrete and steel with adobe? Can we build skyscrapers with adobe?
You're talking about mimicking what we have today, but that doesn't necessarily will work because, for instance, many of the actual growth of the city is horizontal. It's not vertical. Vertical buildings in Tijuana, for instance, they are being built with for a very specific type of users, for a very specific market. Those types of constructions are meant to be built by about 5% of the population. The the great majority of construction in Latin America is actually horizontal. So I think it's a very fair question. Why would you like to mimic skyscraper with adobe? If the key, the most urgent matter is how you create housing for the rest of the people.
Alex's insight made us rethink our original question, not in terms of the performance of biomaterials
like cob or adobe
when compared to the performance of concrete or steel in urban settings, but in terms of the urgent need for affordable housing. So if we start embracing the reality of more horizontal growth, what's stopping more architects from incorporating this into their work?
If you think about it, even the construction that is made with concrete construction and block construction is actually done without architects as well in Latin America.
Right.
About 80 or 85% of the construction in Tijuana is actually made without technical or authorized or specialized supervision. So that very force is right there. It's now working. It's actually in the field working right now. People are building without codes.
Building codes are essential for safe construction, but the majority of people in Latin America don't follow them. However, if people are taught how to build with earth materials, or any material for that matter, they would have the basic fundamentals of how to build in safer ways.
But this is where it gets complicated. What if you wanted to build a bridge, a highway, or a skyscraper?
This is where earth building meets its limits. Turns out that earth building is more susceptible to seismic activity than most other materials. This is why we rarely see an earth building higher than 2 stories in areas that are prone to earthquakes. But to that, Alex has an insight.
When you design a skyscraper, you don't actually have to create a new type of calculation. You use what before was used in other codes or in other instances with where a seismic activity, where an earthquake collapsed a building, and then engineers went down there and used this type of forensic science, forensic structural science, forensic architecture, and forensic engineering, structural engineering. And they create this sort of, how you call it, reverse engineering. And they come up with, we were short in this aspect of design, so we have to create this new system or add this new material or add this new resistance in order to this structure, to this very design, to support, to resist the same earthquake that collapsed it in a new scenario. It's very interesting.
According to Alex, when an earthquake collapses a building
where conventional materials are used,
forensic engineers only look back to see where it failed and make new adjustments to the design and materials. No new systems of calculation have to be created to raise a new structure.
This is what earthbuilding lacks.
It's very interesting. But all those reverse engineering calculations have to finally become codes.
You mean construction codes?
Yeah, construction codes, building codes.
And we stop. A calculation system where we know how the material and design behaves will later become a building code.
So here's where it all made sense.
When Adobe was abandoned, right, from the human civilization, we stopped this experimentation and we stopped this possibility of making codes out of Adobe. So we will have to experiment and we have to let many Adobe structures collapse until we finally learn how to create an Adobe structure that finally works with this scenario you're talking about.
According to Alex, earth materials like Adobe were phased out from city environments by other materials like concrete for various reasons.
Therefore, it missed out on the years of trial and error that other building materials benefited from.
This meant Adobe didn't get to evolve alongside the many technological advancements and improvements that materials like concrete made over the last centuries and decades.
So, when can we actually use Adobe materials to build successfully and in a safe way?
Alex had a guest speaker in one of his classes who shared a crucial insight.
Well, I have a friend who is a structural engineer and an architect, and he currently works in space engineering. So he explained that some of the more efficient structures are actually curved ones and organic.
According to Alex, a structure's resistance has more to do with its shape than with the material it's made of.
That very same structure, talking in the realm of physics and vectors of force and all that stuff, mechanics and classical mechanics, that very form, but reverted or upside down, you create this form that we call the arch or the curve or the dome, right? So the dome and the arch are very efficient types of structures in architecture, very old ones, very ancient structures were built using this system.
Curved shapes, Alex argues, are better at distributing loads and resisting different charges of force when compared to straight ones.
It's concrete and steel construction system that came up with this idea of the grid system that we know right now, which is a type of system that works with pillars, with columns, and beams. This beam and column system that is squared, it's actually less efficient than this curved system. So, hypothetically speaking, you could work anything using any type of material if you use a system that, because of the properties of its form, not its materials, it's more resistant.
That is why most earth buildings are curved, so that they rely on the stability of the shape and less on the strength of the material, like we saw in Miguel Ángel's house or Rachel's compound, or in Diego's cylindrical loft in our last episode. Yet, to build a sturdier structure with earth material, the walls had to be thick and curved.
We're talking at least 20 inches, which means that you have to take up more space, whereas with materials like concrete or cinder block, walls can be as thin as 10 inches, as long as you have something like rebar inside to hold its structural integrity in place.
So concrete, cement, cinder block, and rebar are more efficient, not because of its innate material properties, but because it is a good fit for construction in densely populated areas, like cities that can be arranged in a grid.
Which means you need fewer materials and less space to build sturdier structures. It's simply easier to stack boxes than circles.
So, yeah, you could work with Adobe using that these different types of system. We will have to experiment with them, extract very large amounts of soil to build this experiment. But that will be an answer to your point. We could create some types of skyscrapers, but they will not look like vertical thin structures. They will look like pyramids or like coliseums or any other types of structures.
To be able to have that.
To support itself and to support all the charges of the human activity working on it.
So if we wanted to make Adobe work, we would have to rethink how to design our cities or how to organize our populations.
Currently, as things stand, earth building is more suitable for horizontal growth, like in rural areas where everything is more spread out, while conventional materials like concrete, cement, and cinder block are more suitable for vertical growth, where everything is packed, like in cities.
However, Alex doesn't think that this cannot change. Earth materials just need more time to evolve and to get caught up. Before we left, Alex left us with a final point.
Adobe is a very intelligent response in some regions, like northern Mexico, like southern United States. There is a very specific zone when Adobe makes sense because we have the resources to do that. There are places where it doesn't work. It doesn't quite work in more tropical areas. I don't think it will work in Alaska. I don't think it will work in an island where you are at risk of receiving of hurricanes and tropical storms that can destroy wood and adobe and earth materials, no matter what, which form you use, because of the sheer force of the force of nature.
For Alex, earthbuilding is a solution that should not be adopted everywhere. You have to identify the regions where earthbuilding makes sense and promote it there. It's situational.
Some folks may feel that the time to build this sort of way has long passed, but people like Miguel and Rachel are proof that this way of building may be more attainable than buying a traditional house.
Their stories challenge the notion that conventional construction is the only path to homeownership.
But earth building is not a silver bullet.
Alex's take is a sober reminder of what is possible given a specific set of circumstances.
Like having access to land, location, and material availability.
But with building costs and home prices constantly rising, this alternative is worth a glance.
The good thing is that innovations are being developed as we speak, like machines that bring houses or a more rudimentary press that creates building blocks out of clay.
A simple Google search shows that more and more people are looking for ways to improve these materials as we seek sustainable solutions, ones that minimize our environmental footprint and keep the planetary scale in mind.
Hello?
Yo, ¿qué onda, bro?
Hey, what's up?
¿Cómo estás?
Chillin'.
¿Sí? Oye, wait, would you be down to talk to us about your biodesign and kelp research?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Cool, I'm gonna tell Julio to hit you up.
Sounds good. Tell him to meet me at the Birch Aquarium in La Jolla.
All right, great. I'll tell him to do that. Hablamos. All right,
peace.
All right, peace.
In our next episode, we'll explore proof of concepts from local innovators aiming to replace everyday materials with sustainable alternatives.
And rethink how changing simple things like styrofoam to cardboard in our day-to-day activity may impact our surroundings on a planetary scale.
This episode of Port of Entry was written and produced by Julio César Ortiz Franco.
Adrián Villalobos is technical producer and sound designer. This episode was edited by Elma González Lima Brandao and Melissa Sandoval.
Lisa Morissette is Director of Audio Programming and Operations.
This program is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
This project was also made possible with support from California Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Visit callhome.org.
I'm Alan Lilienthal.
And I'm Natalie González. Nos vemos pronto.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego, presenting For Dear Life, Art, Medicine, and Disability, an exhibition that explores the vulnerable body through the work of over 80 artists. More at mcasd.org.